Blog Talk Radio.
In this show, I'll be talking with writer and director Drew Hall and director and visual effects producer Horst Cerubin. Sit tight while they join us here shortly. Drew and Horst, you guys there?
This is Horst. Hi, this is Drew.
How you doing? How you guys doing today? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome. Fantastic that you guys are here. Well, let's get the show started. For the listeners, I was researching your film. It's incredible. You guys are working on an incredibly cool steampunk-inspired sci-fi film called Aether, The Rise of Spectre. Now, the first question is for you, Drew, and we're going to kind of like, if Horst wants to add anything to the questions, feel free to, and I'm going to kind of go back and forth. As the writer of this project, can you, like, describe what Aether is all about, the plot, the characters, and so forth?
Sure. I'll give what I can in terms of without doing any spoilers, because even though it might be kind of still in the proof of concept phase, I'd hate it if I screwed up and gave away the movie.
It's basically a
big world picture. So it's a universe picture, meaning I kind of consider Star Wars a universe picture. So you get to see this really big part of a universe through the eyes of a group of characters, if you will. And so it's kind of got that feel in one way. The story itself is basically about a group of outcasts, if you will, that live in a town called Spectre, which is literally on the surface of the Earth. And that sounds stupid to say, but in juxtaposition of what we're doing with the story, it'll make more sense. So you have this group of people that live on Spectre, and then you have a group that live in a floating city that's just called Waveland. And it's kind of the classic oppression story. You have this empirical ruling from Waveland, who believes they were put there by the gods, so therefore they have the right to kind of dictate how man and woman should live. And tied into all of that, you have a third race or group, if you will, that's called the Bruin, and they're a group of people that live in these vast mines, if you will. And what they do is they are kind of the careholders and those that are responsible for harvesting ether, which is this gas that in some cases, when a current flows through it, it actually causes buoyancy, almost like being able to have the effect of water or being like a ship on water. But floating, so you end up having ships that can do these really insane things without having jets, and we don't necessarily do steampunk-driven stuff in the classical sense of having helium and dirigibles. We prefer to use the term airships because ours are a little bit different. And so you have ether that is a fuel source, and then in its raw form, much like kind of like gas, in its raw form, people get high off of it. So you have this kind of control over society, so it's very dense in that way. And then that kind of is a metaphor from the film school world. That's kind of a metaphor for a petroleum abuse. You know, we all want it, we all need it, we all use it, but, you know, a lot of people are actually addicted to it to a point of causing toppling of empires, if you will. So it's a very rich story.
Right. I get what you're saying, man. That's incredible. You said, I was reading or watching a video, you said like 10 years in the making. How did you come about, you know, getting all this universe? It's like seems so rich with you know, all these different like classes and social structures. How did you come about like that?
Well, part of it was several years ago. I started on, and what turned me on to steampunk is I'd started a short film called Lightning in the Bottle that was I hate to use this phrase, but it was a parable type short film, right? It had a little moral message in it, and so I started playing around with the style. And I started creating the style because I'm obsessed with Nikola Tesla. And so I was like, oh, I'll make this Tesla-driven idea. And then I started playing around, and I started finding steampunk bits and then kind of diesel punk and Tesla punk and all these different things. And I kind of just gravitated into I can have a fantasy-driven world where they have guns. So I like fantasy stuff, but I like science fiction in a lot of ways in that sci-fi allows me to have crazy-looking guns and blasters and ships doing crazy things instead of dragons. And so for me, it was just a beautiful. And so we just started building. And then when Horst and I, we've been friends for almost 20 years. And so Horst and I have been in the industry together, maybe even longer than 20. We were trying to figure that out today. Anyway, we started playing around with it. And Horst, we both are role players. We started, you know, we're RPG guys. And so Horst and I just started building worlds and adding to it. So I would take my notes from Lightning, and then we'd modify it with the other writer, a guy named Denny Wilkins, and then Horst and I would play on top of it. And so it was just like building a campaign for any other RPG on the planet. We started building a campaign and then kind of reverse engineered it is kind of
wow.
how we went about it.
Wow. Well, Horst, you're with us here as well. There's all kind of, like you had mentioned, cool pieces of technology blended in your films and the universe, like from flying airships, modern gadgets, all that kind of stuff. Now, you've been responsible for the visual effects in the film in many films, including like Iron Man 3 and the Hobbit trilogy, to name a few. Can you tell everybody about how you like go about creating the effects and the look and everything for the
you know,
CGI or whatever for the films?
Of course, and you know, by responsible, I wouldn't say that for Iron Man 3. I was part of the crew that worked on Iron Man 3 and Hobbit.
Okay.
For Ether, I was responsible for that. We Drew and I are very adamant that we want as much in-camera as possible. You've seen probably going throughout the internet right now, there's a little bit of a meme saying, if we're spending all this money and where the technology is getting better and better, why are visual effects getting worse and worse?
Right.
And part of that for me, I mean, like recently, you know, you see large companies, VFX companies, going out of business, even though they're getting Oscars for the film that they just did. And I think part of that is just this mentality that is prevalent now of just, you know, we'll fix it. We'll shoot this and we'll change it later. So Drew and I were very adamant from the beginning that we're going to plan it like they did back in the day. Back when you did Star Wars and you did an effect shot, you know, whether it was a plate in the background or you had some blaster fire or whatever it was, you planned it out and you knew exactly what that was going to look like, and
right.
you shot for that visual effect. Nowadays, quite often you'll see, you know, they'll go, okay, we'll stick an explosion there and then we'll put a hairy gorilla over there, and you know, and you get this, not that it's bad, it's just different, this effect that is more, it's a video game cinematography, it's video game action. And not that that's bad, but that's different than the classic sci-fi that Drew and I grew up on, where the visual effects played to the story, blended into the story, and often were invisible, you know, to the story. They didn't call attention to themselves. So what you see on there, I mean, there's obviously airships are visual effects, but we're trying to get as much of the environment in camera, as much the clouds and all that. They're actual, like when we did a sky replacement, we didn't just make digital clouds. We got actual cloud footage. We, you know, all these plate shots we actually went and shot in New Zealand. And it's to add this, you know, visceral reality to it that we feel is missing when you do everything digitally.
Very interesting. Wow. So I was wondering, you said you shot in New Zealand. There was a, I believe, like a some kind of a fortress or some sort y'all used in the filming location. Where is that located exactly, and how did you guys go about like deciding where they used that as one of the filming locations?
Well, it's a Civil War fort, actually, in the state of Alabama.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's so...
Which, is it one of the ones on the Gulf Coast, or
it is? Yeah, it's on the Gulf Coast. It's called Fort Gaines. Actually, the if we pulled the plates out, I think there's a few shots on the internet somewhere you can see it. We had a beautiful blue sky that day. It was gorgeous, not a cloud in the sky. But if you pull the plates out, it totally looks different, right? We had some set extensions to kind of give it a little bit more sci-fi feel or fantasy feel, and so it's. But the walls themselves are actual. That's, you know, like when they're walking through the town and you're seeing some of the, that is an actual Civil War fort. And Horst and I had originally scouted a different location because there's two forts on the edge of Mobile Bay that face the Gulf. And one of them is huge and massive and we loved it. And on a whim, we were like, let's take the long way and you can go to this Fort Gaines and you can take a ferry to across the bay to the other one. And we happened to walk in Fort Gaines and we became like kids in a candy store, like, oh my God, this looks like a Western town. Oh, we can do this. And so that square footage that we shot is like half the size of the other fort, but the angles were much more interesting. And then, of course, Alex, the DP, is so seasoned. I mean, the guy shot everything from our lifetime and done visual effects on him, that he came in and kind of brought a whole new lens to the image and really made it feel like, okay, we are somewhere else. This is great. So,
So is it hard to get a permit? I guess you have to have some kind of permit to get on. I went to Fort Gaines, but it's been when I was like a little kid, man, years and years ago. So how was it about getting, like, not just the permission, but, like, how much conversion? It seems like you did a lot of conversion for, like, the village scene and all the, you know, the stuff like that.
You know what's great? The state of Alabama and certainly the city of Mobile and the city of Dauphin Island, they all kind of championed us. Like, I mean, they were 100% behind us. So the permit issue came down to, I think, you know, cost-wise, it wasn't very much because we didn't have a huge budget. And what we did have, we obviously need to spend on paying crew and stuff. I think we got the building for really cheap, or the whole location really cheap, rented it for a week. They let us build there, do everything we needed there. And it was because they believed in the idea, which is kind of a weird theme throughout the Ether process, is that anybody that reads it and we kind of show them how passionate and excited we are, they see it as genuine and not just, you know, some Hollywood guys trying to come in and you know, rip people off or turn something around. They see that we care, and then they get excited. And it literally was a painless process. I think normally when you do locations, and Horst and I both were location managers earlier in our career, you have like this constant gurgling in your stomach of stress because you're terrified the location's going to change, or it's a stressful situation to even get it. And this was the opposite. It was like, yeah, sure, come on in, you know, and what little – every film crew is like an army, so they do a little bit of something, you know, that's not perfect. And I think we spilled some makeup on the floor. And they're like, yeah, just make sure you guys have the carpets clean and we're good. And so that's all we had to do, really? You guys are happy? Like, no, we loved having you here. Thanks. Can we promo it? And we're like, yes, please. That's the point. So it's about having a relationship with everyone and not just being like, oh, we're Hollywood and you guys are Alabama, so clear out of our way. That's not how we approach anything that we do, so.
Right, yeah, it looks great. It really fits the whole look and feel of the movie and everything. It looks fantastic. Now, you guys have, like, some Academy Award winners and I believe some nominees working on the film. Like, for the listeners, can you tell a little bit about, like, some of the gifted individuals you've recruited for this film and how, like, it was worth working with their, you know, their back history and how they contributed to it?
Go ahead, Horst.
Sure. Well, when I worked on some of the films in New Zealand, you know, when you work with crew and you make friends and you find the people that you work well with, one of those people that I was very, very blessed to work with was Alex Funke, who has 3 Oscars for visual effects photography, specializing in miniatures. And he has been, you know, like Drew said, just about everything, you know, that the only big thing from my childhood that he didn't do was Star Wars because he was working on something else. I'm like, he's been on Lord of the Rings. He, you know, you'd go back to... did like Buck Rogers TV show. He, you know,
Battlestar.
Battlestar.
Oh,
he's
classic.
Yeah, he's done just about everything. And he's a generous, generous person with his knowledge. He is happy to work. He works hard, and he shares. He's an encyclopedia of visual effects knowledge. And he wanted to come along, and he believes in the project. And the other person through New Zealand was a gentleman named Chris Ward, who did sound design for Hobbit and for King Kong, and he's an Oscar nominee as well. And again, just somebody that, you know, you make friends and you tell them you've got a project, they read it, they believe in your project, they believe in you, and they want to help.
The great part is, like with David and Robin, the other 2 Oscars, none of these were really calling in favors. It was kind of like the favor was, will you read the script and listen to my pitch? And that was the end of the favor. Like, everything else became a passion project. So with David L. Snyder has done tons. Again, another guy that my childhood in the cinema was based on his production design. And he's most known for his Oscar nomination for the art direction on Blade Runner. So obviously when you have the guy that helped Ridley create such an amazing, iconic world come play in your wheelhouse, and you have Alex combined with it and Chris combined with it, it gets great. But then just getting the look of the film in terms of the art direction was solid through David and the production design, but then we wanted to make sure that we didn't infringe upon too far into, like, you know, because Hunger Games did a great job of creating really interesting looks with hair design and all that. So when we started looking around, the producer, Scott Robinson, had a relationship, a working relationship with a lady named Robin Matthews, and Robin's got an Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club, which is amazing because she won an Oscar off of, I think the budget was like $500, I think is the story. And Robin is like, yeah, she's brilliant, man. Like, the lady can make literally magic out of oatmeal. She's a genius. And so having her come in, she just had these great design ideas to kind of make everybody you know, the different classes have these different sort of character pops, and just in makeup and hair, they should. And that's the kind of old school way of doing it was, instead of just throwing the actor up there and letting them always look pretty, throw them up there, let them look pretty, but maybe give them some dirty or give them a weird facial feature or cover up their eyes a little bit, do something a little risky so we can we can maybe go back to where we were. I mean, think about Darth Vader. He wore a helmet the whole time until, Jedi. So, I mean, and it was James Earl Jones' voice, right? It worked.
Right, right, right. Well, you mentioned art design. One of those people you said was you said curious who's responsible for the conceptual art, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Who's responsible for the conceptual art? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
sorry.
Like the look and feel of the concept art. Then I have a question after that.
Horst, that's your guy really that started that process, right?
Yeah, well, we've had a few people. I mean, we've had a guy named Tim Denby from New Zealand, who's an artist at Weta, Weta Digital, who does a lot of the visual effects and big films these days. We've also, of course, David Snyder. That's, you know, part of his job and mission is to guide the look. And very exciting for us, we had Kim Bailey. He is responsible. He does... he does design work, and often he'll do scientific design work. And for me, my geek cred, when I geeked out was when I realized he designed the first Borg ship on Star Trek. He also designed the Stargate and all the symbols with the Stargate.
Wow.
He's been around. Yeah, he's been around forever, and he can build and knows how to build iconic looking things. And we have a ship
and put the science in it. Like
yeah, exactly.
Put the science into it, which is great. So, like, ether isn't air quoted. We actually have quotes ether science that backs up everything that we're claiming, so that it's not just it's not just, you know, it's not midichlorians. We're not going that far into over explaining it, but it has a certain feel to it.
We wanted everything to make sense within the world. You know, we're asking the audience to come along with us in this world, like Drew was saying at the beginning, and you know, we set up the rules for this world, and it needs to make sense. You know, instead of, oh, look, it just flies, it's, you know, it's cool. You know, Kim took the time to design where the ballasts would go and how the ballasts would be energized and then where the exhaust would come from the spent ether and then how that would power the turbine and how, it, you know, because it was, you know, it's a floating thing and not necessarily, you know, an airfoil that has to keep moving forward, how that would fly and how that would maneuver. And, it, you know, it's great. It really adds... When you look at it, it adds that little bit of, yeah, it fits. It belongs. Your brain doesn't question it. You know, your brain doesn't go, oh, that wouldn't happen. Your brain just goes along with the story once you know the world.
Right. Well, there's also, like I was researching on your site, there's also a comic book based off this universe as well. I was wondering, like, is the comic book going, like, about presenting a story, like, based off, like, an adaption of the film, or is it more, like, how's that going, and who's responsible for, like, the creation of the artwork and look at that?
This is true. This is really good. You like this.
Yeah. So, I grew up a comic book kid, still am to a degree. I enjoy my Wednesdays. But the design and the idea behind the comic book was to make it, I didn't want to make anything an adaptation of the film because I think for fans and people who are interested in it, that kind of takes away from it. So what we did was, is we paired up with Blue Water Press and we tied, kind of got together with them and decided that we would do what we're calling Ether Prologue. So in the ideal scenario for it is it's 12 issues. Each issue is roughly a month's time or whatever, but it's the 12 months before the events of the film. So if a fan is loyal from the beginning and they go out, or even after, whatever the case is, and they read the comic and then they see the film, they're going to have inside knowledge and see little jokes and little nods that we're giving to them to say, hey, thank you, and it makes the characters more enjoyable and great. Do they both stand alone? Sure. But it's more fun when you have that kind of cross-collateralization and you can play both sides of it. So we started out playing around with that, and we started just doing the designs, and I wrote the original story, or Horst and I did together. We kind of went back through and made sure that all the rules that we applied in the feature script or the original Ether property were the same in the comic world, the only exception being we have a kind of a collaboration clause that we like to work off of, which is some of the character design in that is not 100% representative of what we might get on film because we did want to allow the artist, because everyone, if you're an artist, I don't want to put you in a box. I want to give you some freedom. And so we did allow them to kind of take some liberties in terms of the way some of the characters look, for example, the way that their designs might be, the clothing bits. They won't be far off, but at least it's them kind of spinning their approach to it. But otherwise, it's a completely original story that gives you a way deeper sense of the world.
Very cool. So you kind of gave them a little creative inspiration, kind of go with the flow. That's pretty cool. Well, there's several aspects of Aether, including, like, the comic we mentioned. Curious, like, what's, like, your overall grand goal for, like, what would you guys like to achieve with the project, like, overall? You know, like, a series of episodes or possibly movies or, like, what's, like, your goal there?
Well, the initial crafting on the picture, like when we started, or I started with a long time ago, was to actually to do a trilogy of pictures. There's one, we have one very beautiful thread. Again, it's universe or etherverse is what we say, but it's etherverse based, and we're seeing this world through the eyes of our heroes, Will and Naya and Isadora and Koala. So we're seeing the story unfold through their eyes, but And so there is a specific story, but each film, the way it's broken down is you have the first picture, which takes place on this island called Dios. The second picture, we head to the mainland, where we actually see that there's a big war going on. There's been almost like World War One kind of vibe. So you have this massive war on a big scale between these different continents and factions within. And then in the third picture, there's a turn in the third picture, which I won't spoil anything, but the turn in the third picture kind of flips the whole world on its head, and you start to realize that there was something kind of sinister all along, and it's a nice little storyline. But again, you've gotten to see, you get to explore, like an RPG, right, if you ever played one, or a video game even.
Right.
It's like more, like you know the map is bigger than it is, but right now you've only been able to unlock this portion of it. Well, each film is like unlocking another series of levels or whatever in the storyline to progress it. That's if we go feature. That same story we could then turn around and apply to, and I think Horst and I both secretly would prefer this because we would like the content. We'd actually like to take it, and very strictly, we want five to six seasons that tell this exact story from beginning to end where you fall in love with these characters. We can explore them even further. We get this great bit, and then you know eventually that the storyline would have to come to a close. And if we did anything else, we built a world, so we can spin off new characters and create a whole other series if they wanted to do that. But the initial idea would be, let's take them through this beautiful story and let everyone experience what we have as a team, as viewers, and like the relationship that we believe is very important, which is the filmmaker to the viewer, and with respect to whoever's funding at the studio or whatever. But we tell this really cool story and always have, like, everything being supplemented. So whether we do features or comic or features or episodic TV style, the comic books keep going, and those have supplementary stories. So if you're reading the comic, watching the movies, you're getting cool extra bits. If we expand out an RPG, there may be hints about things in the RPG that if you read the RPG book because you want to be you're a role player, there's little bits that you're going to know that no one else will know. If we do a game, you're playing the video game, and there's, again, everything is complementary to the universe we're in instead of being retellings of that. So you get to constantly explore and expand and live in that world a little bit, which I haven't done since Star Wars. Like, you know, it's been a long time since I've been able to kind of get lost in a world. So
that's very cool. So it's like such a big universe, man. Well, I have a question. This one's for both of you guys. In your own words, what kind of message are you hoping to deliver to the viewer when they watch the whole universe of Aether and everything?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
My big thing is, as Drew and I have been talking about, coming back to classic sci-fi, coming back to taking back this storytelling thing that we're missing. So as opposed to, you know, a lesson from the story, which there definitely is, and I'll let Drew get into, my big thing is, I want to give back and say, here, have fun. Here's a place that you want to go have fun, you want to go inhabit. Let's go and play in this world together. That's what I want to get across to the fans.
Yeah, and for me, it's there's a lot of nice little metaphorical pieces, like I was referring to the petroleum usage earlier. There's pieces all through it, and I don't like to get preachy, so I let people kind of take what they want from it, right, so they can absorb. But the bigger thing is sometimes finding the big message in the film is sometimes finding your place in the world or universe takes a journey. And it's realizing that that journey is what will eventually, that path is what will show you where you're supposed to be. That will be your destiny, is following that path and not being closed off to it. And you see it very clearly in the first episode with our characters. And as they all go you through this world and the story, you continuously see this arc that, you know, we all face tribulation, we all face challenges, we face heartache, we face wins, we face all of this stuff. But ultimately, those things don't directly define us, but they do influence and they do help shape us. And it's how you choose at the end of the day, that last moment, of how, what you choose after that journey, that's so important. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, where I always intended the moral message of the film to be.
Right. That's awesome, man. What about you, Horst? What are your viewpoints on that?
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, when you present a world and when you present a film, anything, for me, you, of course, can, you know, you put into it your heart and your soul, so it's going to have your beliefs in it, and it's going to have your thoughts and your viewpoints. But when you make a film, you make it with hundreds of other people, and, you know, if you do it right, every one of those people is putting their heart and soul into it. So when a viewer comes to it, as Drew said, I like, you know, of course they're seeing what we've put on screen, but I like for them to come to it and find their own world and find their own points and find their own bits and pieces, because in the end, that's what it's about. It's about your relationship with that thing that you're watching, and, you know, how what do you get from it, and how do you come away from it, and how did it affect you? So I'm really, you know, I really want to see people get into it and explore the world and find that world on their own terms.
Right. Well, I agree totally with you, man. I agree to both of you and Drew as well. Right quick before we end the show, are there any website links or information for people to find out more about Aether and both your various projects and so forth?
Yeah, there's two different places you can go. The primary one for Aether is we have a page set up called aetherprologue.com. It'll take you over. You can see comic books. You can see images. We have an incredible EPK or a press kit where you can actually see really cool videos of behind the scenes, how we made it. There's interviews. There's tons and tons and tons of content to kind of satisfy what you need. You can see the trailer and you can see the whole proof of concept film. It's available at aetherprologue.com. If you're curious about what Horst and I are doing, if you go to our company, it's called frame29films.com, and that's the number 29s. If you head over there, you can kind of see our past projects we have coming up, tidbits, and so on, because we, as filmmakers, we love making, you know, Aether is our passion project. That's our baby. That's the one we've dumped all of our energy and time into thus far. But we also have other projects that we gave the equal amount of respect as we kind of prepped for it, and projects going forward that have the same. So if anyone's interested, you can go to frame29films.com and check us out.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, guys, it was an absolute pleasure having you both on the show, and I really enjoyed talking with you guys and everything, and I look forward to seeing more of your work, especially Aether. And I just wanted to let you guys know that I really enjoyed this conversation.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was a real treat, man. We appreciate it.
You're most welcome, guys. You too, take care, and good luck with everything, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, man.
Take care. All right, peace.
Bye-bye.